there in his parlor, and all of a sudden he heard the cries of children in the street. There was a loud clamor going on, and he went to the door and looked, and there was Abraham Lincoln walking down the street with his two boys in tow. And they were screaming loudly and making a bunch of racket. And he said, "Mr. Lincoln, what's the matter with the boys?" And Lincoln answered, "Just what's the matter with the whole world? I've got three walnuts and each wants two." So, being a little selfish. When you think about it, me is at the bottom of every sin. Whether it's something like drinking, lust, pride, covetousness, anything that we can think of that is a sin, ultimately there's a form of self or me behind it all. As one writer said, the very heart and root of sin is an independent spirit. We erect the idol of self and not only wish others to worship, but we worship it ourselves. Selfishness takes while love gives. Throughout the Bible, whenever you are studying about true love, agape love, it's never a passive type feeling, is it? It's always active service or active giving is used to express agape love. In John 3 and verse 16, God so loved the world. Well, how did he love the world? How did he express that love? He gave his only begotten son. He did some act to prove that love. In Hebrews 6 and verse 10, for God is not unjust to forget your work and labor of love. He's talking about the Hebrew Christians to whom he's writing. They had a labor of love. Now notice what you have shown towards his name, in that you have ministered to the saints and do minister. They were commended for their sharing, the fact that they were sharing their resources with others, and in that way were putting legs, if you will, on their love. In Galatians 5 and verse 13, Paul writes, for you, brethren, have been called to liberty, only do not use liberty as an opportunity for the flesh. Now notice, but through love, serve one another. So love is not something we just talk about. Love is something that we do. Earlier in the lesson this morning, we talked about the fact that in our culture, there's a very distorted view of love. And that distorted view of love has caused many marriages to fail. Some believe that sexual desire is love. And many marriages come about for that very reason. But sooner or later, that desire is going to wane, or that desire is going to turn elsewhere, and then the relationship is on the rocks. We talked romantic love this morning, that it's at the opposite extreme. I think when I think of romantic love, I think of a teenage girl and how I remember when I was going to high school, the big thing then was that the teenage girls would get their boyfriend's class ring and they would wrap this Angora wool around it and make a big fancy thing about it. And basically it was romantic love in action. Romantic love desires to mold the person into some sort of an image that's really beyond reality. Many people that enter marriage with that idea of romantic love don't realize that they're being selfish in desiring that rather than building their relationship on service and respect. A marriage is only going to be as sound as the foundation upon which it is built. And the soundest foundation that we can build our marriage on is having a partner that has the same desire, great desire that we have for making it to heaven. And then we can work together as partners for that common goal. But romantic love, on the other hand, is idealistic and unrealistic. They believe, people in romantic love, that all of their problems are going to be solved because of this relationship. But sooner or later, they're awakened to the reality of the relationship rather than the fantasy world that they've created. And when that happens, people become angry, they become dejected and depressed. The brethren also can be guilty of having this idealistic, unreal type of love. Sometimes brethren expect that there will never be conflicts that will arise in the congregation or among brethren. And that's just like a marriage built on romantic love. When the honeymoon is over, what happens? Then sparks will fly. So how can we love one another in an unselfish and realistic fashion? I'm going to suggest four simple things. In order to do that, we need to be devoted to one another. Paul said in Romans 12 and verse 10, be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love and honor, giving preference to one another. Again, it's the idea of being putting the other person first. We need to look out for one another. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. If we put others first, it's going to go a long way in keeping peace and harmony in every relationship that we have. Another thing we need to do is seek one another's good. In 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 24, let no one seek his own, but each one the other's well-being. And then we need to serve one another. Galatians 5 and verse 13, for you, brethren, have been called to liberty, only do not use that liberty as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love, serve one another. So let us look in the mirror of self-examination and make sure that we're not being selfish. Well, another characteristic of love is that it's not easily provoked. Provoked suggests the idea of a sharp contention taking place, the idea of exasperation or wrath. Have you ever had a person in your life that you just felt every time that you were around that person, you had to walk on eggs, as we might say? Otherwise, you're going to set them off, and there's going to be problems. Well, such people are obviously lacking in love. In Romans 12 and verse 9, Paul said, let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love. In honor, giving preference to one another. So we need to look in that mirror of self-examination. Are we the kind of person that's easily provoked? Are you considered by your family, your friends, your co-workers, your brethren, as Oscar the Grouch? Remember him from Sesame Street? We don't want to be the kind of person that when people are standing around and they see you coming, they're like, oh, let's go, you know, try to go the other way because you're easily provoked. Again, another Lincoln story. It is said that one time Lincoln dropped some kind words about the Confederates, and a woman that was standing nearby just got really upset about that and said, how in the world can you speak kindly about our enemies? We should rather destroy them than speak kindly about them. And Lincoln answered, he says, madam, do I not destroy them when I make them my friends? Now, I think that's a good thing for us to live by. Let's make friends of people rather than being grouchy and easily provoked. George Herbert said that love makes all hard hearts gentle. One that's not easily provoked, I found this from the Hoosier Farmer. It's the Farm Bureau magazine, and I really related to it, being from agriculture. It said, love is the thing that enables a woman to sing while she mops the floor after her husband has walked across it in his barn boots. So she was not easily provoked. I'm sure that Julie can identify with that. Well, love is not only not easily provoked, it thinks no evil. That phrase literally means does not reckon evil, does not taketh account of evil, as the American Standard says. The New American says does not take into account a wrong suffered. I really like the New International Version because it says it keeps no record of wrongs. You know, there's some people that I swear that they have this little black book, and anytime you make a mistake, they're writing it down in that book. It doesn't matter whether it's a real, something real, but even a perceived wrong, and they're going to keep track of that. They're going to mark it down. I call it the Richard Nixon syndrome. You remember, Richard Nixon supposedly had his enemies list. And some folks are just like that, they never forget something of that nature. To bear a grudge is to take account of wrongs that's not characteristic of love. A wise man said in Proverbs 10 and verse 12, hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all sins. In chapter 17 and verse 9, he said, he who covers a transgression seeks love, but he who repeats a matter separates friends. Again, another Lincoln story. Lincoln received on a regular basis, he had to take care of discipline in the military. And each time there was a soldier being disciplined, and it was something that rose to a nature where it had to come across his desk, there were always these letters of support to help the soldier that was in trouble. Well, one day it's reported that a single sheet of paper came to him with an appeal from a soldier, and it didn't have any supporting documents whatsoever. Lincoln exclaimed, "What? Has this man no friends?" And his assistant replied, "No, sir, not one." And then Lincoln replied, "I will be his friend." So let us think no evil. Let's not keep track of wrongs, whether they're real or perceived. Another thing that's characteristic of love is that it does not rejoice in iniquity. Does not delight in evil, as the New American or New International Version says. Have you ever met a person that took delight in the sins and the misfortunes of others? I mean, they just can't wait to tell you what happened. They have a look of joy, almost joy on their face. Did you hear what happened to so-and-so? Did you hear what so-and-so did? Well, that's not the kind of characteristics that we would have as Christians. In 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 12, Paul talked about some people that had pleasure in unrighteousness. And what a sad thing when people have pleasure in the misfortunes and the failings of other people. Winston Churchill once said that truth is incontrovertible. Panic may resent it, ignorance may deride it, malice may distort it, but there it is. Another man said that truth makes the devil blush. So if we have love as Christians that we should have, that Paul is describing for us here, we're going to rejoice in the truth. We're not going to kick out of someone's sin and misfortune. We're going to enjoy the company and the fellowship of those who love righteousness and seek it first in their lives. 2 John 3 and verse 4, verses 3 and 4. John writes, "Grace, mercy, and peace be with you from God the Father and from the Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of the Father, in truth and love. I rejoice greatly that I have found some of your children walking in truth as we receive the commandment from the Father. I don't think much better thing could be said of us than, you know, Craig is one who walks according to the truth, or Mike is one who walks according to the truth, and that should be the desire of all of us. A lot of quotes in this lesson, but another good one. This man said, truth without charity or without love is often intolerant and even persecuting, as charity or love without truth is weak in concession and untrustworthy in judgment. But charity, loyal to the truth and rejoicing in it, has wisdom of the serpent with the harmlessness of a dove. Well, another characteristic of love is optimistic. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. That's optimism, isn't it? It bears up under wrongs and keeps on going. It believes in the good and always hopes for the best. Always looks for the best in people rather than the worst. It endures the darkest night, trusting that the morning's going to dawn bright and sunny. I would like for you to think about your wedding day. I hope it was a happy day, as it was for me. But it was a day of optimism. And I think most weddings are just that. Because love made all things seem possible. I don't think I've ever seen a couple on their wedding day being pessimistic. I think that's actually pretty rare. But love makes people look at the bright side of things. It's not that they don't see the bad side of things, but they make a conscious choice and a great effort to see the good and then to do the good. Well, our last point about love is that it never fails. Think of how great and wonderful it would have been to have lived in the first century and have been a Christian. Been able to sit at the feet of the apostles and hear Paul or Peter or John preach the gospel. Think of how much of an honor it would have been to have had one of the spiritual gifts. In 1 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul enumerates the gifts. If you remember, there were 9 of them: prophecy, knowledge, wisdom, faith, healing, working of miracles, discerning of spirits, tongues, and the interpretation of tongues. Perhaps one of the greatest things about a spiritual gift was, how did you receive that gift? You had to have the direct laying on of the hands of one of the apostles. Furthermore, a great thing about a gift was it wasn't for your edification, it was for the edification of everybody. In 1 Corinthians 12 and verse 7, Paul said, the manifestation of the Spirit is given to each one for the profit of all. And think of how important these gifts were there in the first century. They didn't have the written New Testament like we have. They needed these gifts to guide them so that they would be practicing that which was truthful. Yet, what was going to happen to those gifts? Turn over to 1 Corinthians 13, beginning in verse 8. He says, love never fails, but whether there are prophecies, whether they will fail. Whether there are tongues, they will cease. Whether there is knowledge, it will vanish away. These spiritual gifts were only temporary. For one thing, once the apostles passed away, there would be no way to receive these gifts. They were for a limited purpose and a limited time. Paul goes on in verse 9, for we know in part and we prophesy in part. We don't have the completed New Testament yet, but when that which is perfect has come, the perfect law of liberty, I think, is what he's talking about, the New Testament, then that which is in part will be done away. When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know just as I also am known. And now abides faith, hope, love, these three. But the greatest of these is love. My favorite line from the Amazing Grace is the line that says, when we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun. But when we have been there 10,000 years, what will be the case? Love never fails. We will no longer need hope. After we've seen, we no longer need hope. We will no longer need faith. But one thing we still will need is love. Well, that's our lesson on love. As we bring it to a conclusion, I want to remind you how Paul started this chapter about love. He says, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I become a sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. Love is the most important characteristic for us as Christians. Over in 1 John chapter 4, John has an important section here on love, beginning in verse 10. Sometimes it's hard for me to find my verses in my new Bible because they're interspersed as paragraphs. I'm not used to that. Okay, where's my 10? Okay, here it is. Verse 10, in this is love, not that we love God, but that he loved us and sent his son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one God at any time. If we love one another, God abides in us, and his love has been perfected in us. By this we know that we abide in him and he in us, because he has given us of his Spirit. And we have seen and testified that the Father has sent the Son as Savior of the world. Whoever confesses that Jesus is the Son of God, God abides in him and he in God. And we have known and believed the love that God has for us. God is love, and he who abides in love abides in God and God in him. Love has been perfected among us in this, that we may have boldness in the day of judgment. Because as he is, so are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves torment. But he who fears has not been made perfect. We love him because he first loved us. If someone says, I love God, and hates his brother, he is a liar. For he who does not love his brother, whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he has not seen? And this commandment we have from him, that he who loves God must love his brother also. Without love, we're just a shell of a person, and certainly not manifesting the life of Christ in our life. So let us all examine ourselves. Let us make sure that we are working on these characteristics of love that Paul has enumerated for us. Again, we don't have to do some big, great, wonderful sacrifice to be pleasing to God. We just need to walk in these very simple things that he's given to us. If you're here tonight and you've not been walking as you should, if you have not obeyed the gospel, we encourage you with all the encouragement we can muster to not leave this building tonight without being right with God. Again, judgment will come, and the books will be open, as it says in Revelation chapter 20, and we'll be judged according to the things in God's book. And one of those things will be what we've studied from 1 Corinthians 13. If you're here and there's any way we can help you, we ask you to come forward while we stand and sing.